So let me start by thanking Lucien and Paul for inviting me to talk today. So the talk is going to explore how a lot of non-classical phenomena can be viewed in one of these two ways. On the one hand, some of them emerge naturally from the notion that there's a restriction on how much you can know. So there are toy theories wherein one can make strict sense of this. And on the other hand, phenomena for which that's not the case, a large number of them tend to be found to be instances of contextuality. So that's the big picture. The talk is mostly going to be about contextuality, but I'll start off by saying something about epistemic restrictions. So if you look at some recent work in quantum foundations, I find that a lot of it argues that perhaps the following principle might be an axiom for quantum theory, namely that maximal information about reality is incomplete information. So even after the observer has acquired all the information he or she can, there's still something missing. So the observer is still ignorant of something. So I find all of these papers provide evidence for that sort of thesis. However, if you're working within a classical framework, assuming a restriction on knowledge is not enough to get you quantum theory. So let me give you an example of a reason for believing in the power of epistemic restrictions. This is just going to be a quick mention of a toy theory that I described in this quantum pH article. So the idea is that every system has four possible internal states, topologic states. And then there's an epistemic restriction, which basically says the only probability distributions that can characterize your knowledge of the system are uniform distributions with two of these states. So you can never have a distribution that's peaked at just one of the points. But you can have lots of different ways of knowing about the system. And it turns out that these different ways of knowing about the system end up being analogous to these quantum states for a two-level system. And you could also know nothing. And you can go on and ask, what about two systems? What can you know about two systems? And you find that correlations and those things are analogous to entanglement. And you can explore the theory. You derive it all from an axiom which states this epistemic restriction. And you find that that axiom is extremely fruitful in getting you phenomena that are qualitatively analogous to quantum phenomena. So you can get an analog of coherent superposition, bipartite entanglement, tripartite entanglement, the monogamy of entanglement, the fact that a mixed state has many decompositions into pure states, and various formal features, the number of mutually unbiased bases, Neumark-Einstein spring extensions, general cascade morphism, all that sort of stuff. And also you get a number of quantum phenomena, such as no cloning, teleportation, key distribution, and so on. Now, we heard this morning that a lot of these features are actually generic to any non-classical theory, so maybe it's not so stunning. So I think an interesting question here is, does an epistemic restriction buy you more than you'll generically get in an operational theory that's non-classical? My impression is that it does. So Matt mentioned that teleportation was a phenomenon that seemed to distinguish, but that was not generic. And in these sorts of toy theories, you do get teleportation. And there's a few other phenomena I can point to which seem to be more difficult to get. There could be a whole talk about this sort of stuff, but I'm sort of going to end it there and just emphasize that these toy theories don't get you everything. And you can make a list of the sorts of phenomena that you can't reproduce. And one of them is the fact that you have no Bell Cauchon-Speckert theorem within these toy theories. So they're non-contextual, whereas quantum theory is contextual. These theories are local, so you have no violations of Bell inequalities. You also have things like the fact that these theories tend to fail to reproduce the full set of quantum states, measurements, and transformations. They only produce analogs of some subset of them. There's no exponential speedup, and the list goes on. So if you're interested in pursuing this sort of research program where you want to find out whether you can derive quantum theory from some constraint on information, and something else, then these are the sorts of phenomena you want to look at, because they're the ones that will teach you about the something else. And you can start basically making two lists. You can try to categorize phenomena. You know, can I explain this phenomena within some sort of toy theory that is in the epistemic restriction, or can I not? And it's, as I said, it's these sorts of ones that are most interesting for the research program. So I don't have an axiomatization of quantum theory to offer you, but all I argue is that there's a research program here which seeks a particular kind of axiomatization within a realist approach to quantum theory, and it appears to be promising. So the approach, you know, very roughly stated, so I'm just trying to give you the big picture here, is to be conservative and try to keep as much of your classical notion of reality as possible. And then you introduce an axiom that says there's a restriction on how much any observer, or any system in the universe for that matter, can know about the real state of the systems with which he interacts. That's the epistemic restriction. And there has to be some second axiom which captures the rest, and I don't know what that is, but presumably it's some change to our classical notion of reality. And what I want to argue is that the phenomenon of contextuality seems to be a kind of umbrella for a lot of the phenomena that are missing from these toy theories. And so it may be that contextuality is one of our best clues for how to proceed with this sort of research program. Right, so what can you get from contextuality? So here's a list. I'm going to introduce a sort of a general definition of contextuality eventually. But let me go through the list first. First of all the previous theorems, which we call proofs of contextuality, go through under this general notion as proofs of contextuality. So all the variants of the Bell-Cochin-Specker theorem, which includes not just the algebraic proofs, but state-specific proofs, statistical proofs, proofs that are discrete, proofs that are continuous. There's a whole zoology of these things. They're all proofs of contextuality. All proofs of Bell's theorem are also instances of contextuality. So roughly speaking, when you say that your hidden variable theory is non-local, you're saying that it not only depends on the context here, where the system is, but at a space-like separated point. So it's context-dependent far away. And there's a number of novel no-go theorems that you can derive. They're all instances of contextuality. The fact that quasi-probability representations always go negative, things like the Wigner function going negative. Certain aspects of pre- and post-selected paradoxes or experiments with pre- and post-selected ensembles. Just recently, I was able to show that certain kinds of information processing tasks, such as oblivious transfer, actually are powered by contextuality. All variants of von Neumann's no-go theorem, so von Neumann's theorem and other things in the literature which actually make the same assumptions as von Neumann, turn out to be proofs of contextuality in this generalized sense I'm going to introduce as well. And then finally, there's some other things that I think might be instances of contextuality, but I'm not sure. Yes?
Do you think that contextuality can also give you an epistemic restriction on a new model in some sense? It should be related.
I see, if you're working within a completely classical standard hidden variable framework where there's a pre-existing reality and you're finding out about it, then you can have contextuality and an epistemic restriction together. So you can say, well, you know, I have a lack of information, but in a sense, my lack of information depends not just on the way I represent this procedure in the quantum formalism, but also on context. So yeah, they do go hand in hand. So it's sort of like saying you have to have an epistemic restriction and contextuality.
Right, but it's hard to imagine contextuality without the epistemic restriction. That's what I'm saying. So maybe it's all contextuality.
If you take just an orthodox approach, wherein the ontic states are points in a projective Hilbert space, then you have contextuality. because every comparable model quantum theory is contextual, but you don't have an epistemic restriction. And I argue that, you know, that's the wrong course to follow, that you'll run into trouble with those sorts of interpretive strategies. Right, so this talk is basically going to focus on the last item on that list. I could give a talk about each one of them, and there's no time. I thought it would be better to go in depth into one of them than to go over a number of them. So I'm going to talk about why von Neumann's no-go theorem is a proof of contextuality. But first, I have to explain to you what this generalized notion is. And I'm going to generalize it to both arbitrary experimental procedures and to operational theories, so theories that aren't quantum theory. And then I'll end with some conclusions. Right. Okay, so most people here may know that in 1966, Bell proved that there's no non-contextual hidden variable model quantum theory for Hilbert spaces dimensionality 3 or greater, and Koshin and Specker proved it independently in 1967. And instead of this mouthful, I'm often going to just say that quantum theory is contextual. And I'm using that the same way that when we say quantum theory is non-local, we really mean it is impossible to find a local hidden variable model of quantum theory. So this would be shorthand for the impossibility of a non-contextual in variable model of quantum theory. So this result is known as the Bell-Koshin-Specker theorem. And I want to complain about the traditional notion of contextuality on three counts. First of all, it applies only to quantum theory. So unlike our notion of locality, which we can ask of an arbitrary theory, is it local or not, contextuality seems to be defined just for quantum theory. So we'd like it to be applicable to arbitrary theories. Secondly, it only applies to sharp measurements, that is, projective measurements, but we'd like to apply it to POVMs, unsharp measurements, and it'd also be nice to apply to preparation procedures and transformations, actually, and so you can generalize it in that way. And then third of all, it's defined for deterministic hidden variable models, and you'd again like to have it more general than that. So here's the proposed new definition, which is that a non-contextual hidden variable model of an operational theory is one wherein if two experimental procedures are operationally equivalent, then they have equivalent representations in the hidden variable model. So I'm going to go on to define precisely what all these terms are, but roughly speaking, if you can't tell the difference between two experimental procedures at a statistical level, then there should be no difference in how you represent them in the hidden variable model. So let me start by saying what I mean by an operational theory. So we heard a bit about this from Matt. I'm going to eliminate the transformation procedures because that would just add too many complications. So let me just imagine I have a preparation procedure and a measurement procedure. The measurement procedure is distinguished by the fact that it yields some outcome. They both have knobs, you can set, and a go button. And basically, they're defined by lists of instructions of what to do in the lab. There's no mention of microscopic systems and properties of those systems. It's just what you do in the lab. And what the theory is designed to do, ultimately, is specify the probability for different outcomes of a measurement given a description of that measurement and the preparation procedure that preceded it. So the theory just gives you a bunch of algorithms like this. Now, within that context, I can define an equivalence relation among procedures. So let's take preparation procedures to start with. I'm going to define P and P prime to be operationally equivalent if they yield the same probability distribution over outcomes for every possible measurement you could do. So here's a cartoon of it. I have two preparation procedures. I bring the first measurement up to both. I calculate the statistics. I find they're the same. I do the same for the second measurement, statistics are the same, and so on. I go through my whole battery of tests, statistics are always the same. I conclude these two preparation procedures are operationally equivalent. They may be different in some ways. They may involve very different things done in the lab, but from the perspective of all future measurements I can do, I can't tell them apart. Similarly, I can define equivalence for measurement procedures. So it's very similar. two measurement procedures are equivalent if, with respect to my full battery of possible preparations, their statistics are identical. Okay, now what's a hidden variable model of such an operational theory? Well, it basically takes seriously the idea that these devices actually are spinning out systems with properties, and they're priming them. So you're now not just talking about listed instructions of things to do in the lab, but systems and their properties. So the idea is that when I know the list of instructions of what's done in the lab, then that allows me to infer a particular probability distribution over the real physical states of the system, which I'll label lambda, the ontic states, if you will. So I have some probability distribution, which depends on the particular preparation procedure I did. So what this says is that although I know everything here, I might not know everything about the real state. I might just have limited information. And similarly with a measurement, I represent a measurement as a probability distribution over the different outcomes of that measurement for every real physical state that I might feed into the device. So over here, for example, there's some probability of getting the first outcome, and some probability of getting the second outcome, and zero probability of getting the third. Again, the assumption here is that even if you knew exactly what the real state fed into the device was, it might not deterministically set what the outcome of that measurement is. The outcome might still be indeterministic for a given physical state fed into it. So I call these things indicator functions. They just tell me the likelihood of getting each of these three outcomes for all lambda. They have to be between 0 and 1 and sum up to the uniform function at every value of lambda. And of course, if I want this hidden variable model to reproduce the predictions of my operational theory, then when I ask for the probability of getting outcome k, given that the state was lambda, times the probability it was lambda, given that the preparation was p, and I integrate over lambda, I had better get the overall probability of outcome k. Right, okay, so now finally, after all that prepping, I can define what I mean by non-contextuality in an operational theory. So preparation non-contextuality is the assumption that if two preparation procedures are operationally equivalent, then they're associated with exactly the same distribution over the ontic states, or the hidden variables, if you will. So this is the cartoon. If I can't tell these apart, then I represent them the same way. And of course, any differences that exist between the list of instructions here and here can be thought of as a kind of context to the preparation. And so what we're saying is that the nature of this distribution does not depend on the context. So good reason to call it non-contextuality. You can do a similar definition for measurement non-contextuality. If two measurement procedures are operationally equivalent, then the set of indicator functions I associate with the two should be exactly the same. Okay, so let's apply it now to quantum theory. In quantum theory, two preparation procedures are operationally equivalent if and only if they are associated with the same density operator. So what that means is that these probability distributions in my hidden variable model can depend only on the density operator and not anything else. So for example, two preparation procedures might correspond to the same density operator, but involve different mixtures of pure states. So there's many ways of decomposing a mixed state into an ensemble of pure states. In a preparation non-contextual hidden variable model, that difference cannot be significant. So when I average over two ensembles, I should get the same distribution. And similarly, in quantum theory, two measurement procedures are equivalent if they're associated with the same POVM, and so these sets of indicator functions can depend only on the nature of the POVM. So, before I move on, are there questions about that so far? No? All right. Let me now tell you how this fits with the traditional notion of non-contextuality. So this might look more familiar to some of you. So in the context of a three-dimensional Hilbert space, people often characterize the assumption of non-contextuality as follows. If I have a triple of orthogonal quantum states psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and another triple that has psi 1 in common, with psi 2 prime and psi 3 prime, then in the hidden variable model, thinking of this as a measurement, for every state of the hidden variables, there should be some deterministic outcome for that measurement. So here it'd be saying, you'll definitely get the outcome 1, and you won't get outcomes 2 or 3. If I were to do this other measurement, then I should also get the outcome 1, so that this psi 1 element always gets the same outcome, regardless of what it's measured together with. So another example would be, it could be assigned the state, it could be, the values of the hidden variables could be such that a psi 1 does not occur as the outcome of the measurement, but some other result occurs. So this is also consistent with the assumption of non-contextuality. So now let's draw that slightly differently, which is to say that at every value of lambda, the value 0 or 1 that gets assigned to the first outcome has to be the same. So as I go across here, the indicator function I associate with psi 1 in this measurement has to be the same as the indicator function I associate with psi 1 in this measurement. The indicator functions for the other two can, of course, be different. But now, the way I hook it up with what I just defined as non-contextuality is that I can define a new measurement procedure which involves coarse grading of the outcomes 2 and 3. And in the hidden variable model, that will just involve coarse grading of those two indicator functions I showed you before. I can define another procedure where I coarse grade psi 2 prime and psi 3 prime. And the point is that these two things now are operationally equivalent. They're both associated with the same projector value measure. And so according to the definition I just proposed, they should be associated with exactly the same sets of indicator functions. And sure enough, the traditional definition agrees. It says that because chi 1 has to be the same in the two cases, then chi not 1 has to be the same as well. So it agrees with the traditional definition. But there's a difference, which is that I assume that the most general representation of a projective measurement could involve non-deterministic indicator functions, what Mack called fuzzy indicator functions. And so you see then that the traditional notion of non-contextuality involved a stronger assumption, not just this revised notion of non-contextuality, which I described to you, but also an assumption that sharp measurements have deterministic outcomes. So the definition I'm proposing is not just a generalization of the traditional definition, it's actually a revision. I'm saying that there was an element of that traditional definition that I want to get rid of. The assumption that outcomes should be deterministic for sharp measurements, I want to extract from the notion of non-contextuality. And to provide an argument for this, I'm going to make an analogy with the definition of locality. So Bell famously extracted the notion of determinism from the notion of locality. So let me explain. The assumption of local determinism, what's sometimes called local determinism, is an assumption to determine whether some theory is locally deterministic. You ask whether the outcome of measurement depends on space-like separated events, in addition to depending on the local settings of that measurement apparatus and the hidden variables. But Bell's notion of local causality generalized this and specify that one should ask instead whether the probability of the outcome, not the value of the outcome, but the probability of the outcome, whether it depends on space-like separated events in addition to local measurement settings and the value of the hidden variables. And so in this way, he was able to discuss whether indeterministic hidden variable models were local or not. And so the suggestion I'm making is that we introduce the same sort of distinction for non-contextuality. The traditional notion asks whether the outcome of a measurement depends on the measurement context, in addition to depending on the observable you're measuring and the hidden variables. And the proposed revised notion asks simply whether the probability of the outcome depends on the measurement context, in addition to these other factors. So it's the same transition, where you stop asking about the outcome and you just ask about dependencies of the probability of the outcome on the context or the space-like separated event. So the point is that non-contextuality and determinism are separate issues. They can be cleanly distinguished, and we should do so. Yes.
So, if I think like an information theorist,
yes,
and start taking asymptotic limits of, you know, infinitely many repeats of something, then distinct probabilities correspond to distinct events.
Yes.
Does that allow me to recover the initial one by taking an asymptotic limit of your definition? So that, in other words, if the probability errors are different, then that implies that some deterministic outcome for infinitely many events is different? Or is there a, do I run into a snag there?
Well, here what we're really talking about are the probabilities of the outcome conditioned on the value of lambda. That's what we're really inquiring about. And so now you would be asking about the probabilities conditioned on the lambdas of everything. I think it seems to me like you would get a deterministic prediction given just the preparation procedure. You would say, for this preparation procedure, I predict these relevant frequencies. But that's not the kind of conditioning I want in this probability. Right, so the traditional notion is this revised notion that I've introduced for sharp measurements together with an assumption of outcome determinism for sharp measurements. And now that's a problem, because the no-go theorems that we're used to are not necessarily no-go theorems for this new notion of non-contextuality. When you find a contradiction, you can just say, it was outcome determinism for sharp measurements that was the problem, let's abandon it. So we're adrift. All of a sudden, all the previous proofs of non-contextuality aren't proofs of the new notion of non-contextuality. Fortunately, you can solve the problem by noting that this notion of preparation non-contextuality actually allows you to derive outcome determinism for sharp measurements. So let me sketch the proof briefly. Suppose you have an orthogonal basis in a three-dimensional space. Assume the contrary and write the contradiction. So assume that outcome determinism for sharp measurements doesn't hold. So that there's some values of lambda such that the probabilities for getting outcome 1 and outcome 2 are both non-zero. Well, you know that if you were to prepare the state psi 1, for example, you would have to get the outcome 1. So it has to have no overlap with the indicator function for outcome 2 and outcome 3. And similarly, the probability distribution associated with the preparation of psi 2 can have no overlap with the indicator function for psi 1 because it always generates the second outcome. So this region here doesn't have any overlap with those distributions. But I know that there's some quantum state, I'll call it psi, which does have non-zero weight in this region. Because if all quantum states assign zero weight to that region, then I wouldn't even need to define the indicator functions in that region, and they'd be outcome deterministic for all the hidden variables that matter. So you need to assume that there's some quantum state that assigns non-zero probability here. All right, now we're almost done. The point is that these three states, when I take an equal mixture of projectors onto these three states, I get the completely mixed state, identity over 3. There's also some convex decomposition of the completely mixed state that incorporates psi. So there's some ensemble which has psi and some other things in it that also yield the decomposition. The assumption of preparation non-contextuality says when I sum up those two ensembles, I have to get exactly the same distribution on the left-hand side. There can't be distinctions here. And that's in contradiction with the fact that the sum of these distributions is zero in this region, whereas the sum of these guys is non-zero. So I'm done. Right, so what have we established? That we can derive outcome determinism sharp measurements from a sort of non-contextuality. So if you assume non-contextuality for all sorts of experimental procedures, measurements and preparations, then you get measurement non-contextuality and outcome determinism, which is just the traditional notion, and therefore all the previous no-go theorems which relied on the traditional notion can be salvaged as no-go theorems for the possibility of having both of these. But in addition to all those traditional proofs, there's a number of new proofs you can come up with for this sort of non-contextuality. So usually at this point I would provide a very simple proof of non-contextuality in a two-dimensional Hilbert space to give you a flavor for that sort of thing. But as a result, I never get to talk about anything else because it always takes up all my time. So today, I'm not going to do that. And at the risk of losing those who haven't seen it before, I'm going to give you a more complicated proof. But it's going to shed light on the connection with von Neumann's NOVA theorem. So before I do that, let's just remind ourselves of the list of phenomena I said are forms of contextuality. So I've just shown you that, you know, all the traditional proofs go through as proofs of this new notion of contextuality. All the forms of Bell's theorem also go through. And then, as I said, there's these novel sorts of NOVA theorems. And you can get these NOVA theorems even in two-dimensional Hilbert spaces. Because all you really need is a scenario wherein, for instance, you have a POBM that can be implemented in multiple different ways. Or you have a mixed state that can be decomposed in convexly in two different ways. And this is enough. You have this already in 2D, and so you have enough structure to actually derive a contradiction with this more general notion of non-contextuality. This feature is basically, if you take this notion of non-classicality that we have, an intuitive notion, which is, you know, negativity of the Wigner function, that's non-classicality, and you push it, you realize it's not very good. What you actually want to do is you want to talk about whether the measurements and the preparation procedures get positive representations in your Wigner representation. So you don't want to just look at the representations of the states, you want to look at the representations of the measurements as well. That's a better notion of non-classicality, having negativity in one of those two places. It's still not perfect, though, because, for instance, if I have preparations and measurements that are both diagonal in, say, the number basis, well, both those things have negative Wigner representations, but there's a very simple classical model of those sorts of effects. So ultimately, where you land is there any quasi-probability representation of quantum theory that is positive for all the preparation procedures and all the measurement procedures? And once you've landed at that notion of non-classicality, it turns out it's precisely the same as a non-contextual hidden variable theory. Because implicit in all these quasi-probability representations was the notion that I represent a density operator by a single function, the Wigner function. And it doesn't depend on how that density operator was built out of pure space. So there was always an implicit notion of non-contextuality in these sorts of approaches. So in joint work with Matt Liefer, we've explored the connection between contextuality and some of these pre and post selected ensembles. I won't say much about that. I'm quite excited about this recent work with Ben Toner, which shows that one out of two oblivious transfers, which is a kind of information theoretic primitive for cryptography, is actually powered by contextuality in the sense that if you want to do better than you can in a classical universe, and you can do better in a quantum universe than you can in a classical universe, but if you want to imagine any theory for the world that allows you to do better than in a classical universe, that theory is going to have to be contextual. So that's sort of a brief survey, but I'm going to focus on von Neumann's NOVA theorem. All right, so what are von Neumann's assumptions about hidden variable models from which he derives his contradiction? Well, first of all, he assumes that every Hermitian operator is represented by some function over the hidden variable space, and that the function takes values only inside the spectrum of that Hermitian operator. And so in particular, if that Hermitian operator is a projector, then its spectrum is just 0 or 1. Therefore, this function can only take one of those two values. If the Hermitian operator is the identity operator, then it has to have the value 1. This is the assumption of dispersion-free ensembles, that the lambda specifies precisely a value for every projector. And then his controversial assumption is that if you have A equal to B plus C, where A, B, and C don't need to commute, then the function associated with A should be the sum of the functions associated with B and C. This goes beyond the traditional notion of non-contextuality, because the traditional notion only demands this in the case where A, B, and C commute. And then von Neumann proves that such a hidden variable model of quantum theory, satisfying these assumptions, doesn't exist. I'll give you a quick synopsis of that proof. If this third assumption holds, then the function at B plus C is just the sum of the function B plus the function C. And then you just make use of this lemma, which says that any function that's linear over Hermitian operators must have the form of an inner product with some Hermitian operator omega. And so that means that because f, as a function of its subscript, is indeed linear, then at every value of lambda, there must be some Hermitian operator omega of lambda that defines f a of lambda. But I also know that for a, a projector, this takes value 0, 1, so it's always positive. But the only Hermitian operators such that trace with all projectors, I still get something positive, are the positive operators. And I know that if A is identity, then the thing has to be 1. So plug identity in here, you get the trace of this Hermitian operator has to be 1. So I conclude that this thing's a density operator. And now I look at von Neumann's second assumption, which was that the projectors get value 0 and 1. And I discover that it's actually in conflict with what I've derived here, because there's no density operator that assigns value 0, 1 to all the projectors in the Hilbert space, and I have my contradiction. So for those of you who are familiar with that proof, it's probably obvious, and for those of you who are not, that was probably too fast. So let me give you a much simpler version of the proof, which I'm not sure exactly who wrote it down first, but you know, it's mentioned in Ballantyne's review article, defined in Belafonte's book, variation of this in Belafonte's book. And here's the idea. Here's your A, B, and C. These are just spin observables for a spin half particle. So spin along X, spin along Y, and then there's some axis N, which is between the two. This is the relation that holds between the spin observables. I know that the function associated with each of these has to have values confined to their spectra. So this function, if I set h bar equal to 1, has to have value minus a half or a half. Each of these has to have value minus a half or a half. So the possible sums on the right-hand side are just minus 1 over root 2, 0, or 1 over root 2. So there's no way of getting equality. Done. You have your contradiction. I think it's an interesting historical question why von Neumann didn't just present this as his no-go theorem. But maybe we can talk about that later. And then, just a sort of side note, which is that recently there's been progress on the Born's problem, which relates the spectra of A, B, and C when A is equal to B plus C. And I have a project with Joe Emerson and Matthias Sandel trying to figure out whether that might tell us something interesting about the structure of von Neumann no-go theorems. Right, okay, so that's the proof. But the real question that always comes up here is whether von Neumann's assumptions were good assumptions to make about a hidden variable model. What I want to argue is that this generalized notion of non-contextuality for preparations and measurements that I've introduced actually allows you to derive von Neumann's starting assumptions. So any no-go theorems that are based on von Neumann's assumptions can be salvaged as no-go theorems for this generalized notion of non-contextuality, and I add them to the list. So here are his assumptions again. Can we justify the first one? Yes, that's just an assumption of non-contextuality for sharp measurements. Because it basically says that the way I represent this observable depends only on the observable and not on how I implemented it, nothing about the context. The second assumption can actually be justified by preparation non-contextuality. Remember I told you that outcome determinism for sharp measurements can be derived from preparation non-contextuality. And it turns out that this second assumption of von Neumann's is just equivalent to outcome determinism for sharp measurements, because it says that a projector should be assigned value 0 or 1 at every lambda in the hidden variable model. If I allowed this to be any number between 0 and 1, then it would be denying outcome determinism for sharp measurements. So this assumption isn't a problem either. It can ultimately be justified by a kind of non-contextuality. That leaves us to the third assumption, and that's always the contentious one. This is sometimes referred to as von Neumann's silly assumption, in particular that it should hold when A, B, and C don't commute. And what I want to convince you of is that you can justify this by appealing to non-contextuality for unsharp measurements, which is one of the innovations that this approach yields. Okay, so here's the proof of that claim. Suppose I have my three operators, A is equal to B plus C. Suppose this is how I denote their spectral decompositions. So little a, little b, and little c are their eigenvalues. So then just plugging that back into the equation, I get this relation among the projectors and their spectral resolutions. And now I use a, sort of an old trick that comes up a lot in this sort of literature, which is you take the negative eigenvalue terms from this side and you move them over to the right, and the negative eigenvalue terms from the right-hand side and you move them over to the left. And so what you're left with is all the terms on the left-hand side have positive coefficients, and all the terms on the right-hand side have positive coefficients as well. So each side is a positive operator. And now just find what the maximum of all these coefficients is, and then divide by 3 times that maximum coefficient. This factor of 3 is going to come up later. It's not important. The key thing is that what you're left with is all these things are now less than 1, so they can be interpreted as probabilities. What you have left over on the left and on the right are effects. And so what this equation tells me is that here is a quantum effect that can be decomposed into projectors in 2 different ways. And you can now use that to deduce something about how these projectors, or how these effects are going to be represented in the Hin-Varian model. And you'll find an equation in terms of the indicator functions associated with each of these projectors, an equation that exactly parallels this one. And so that's the next step I have to convince you of. This is the difficult part of the proof. And it's going to follow from non-contextuality for unsharp measurements. So this is a complicated experiment. Let me walk you through it. The idea is that it's an experiment, it's a sort of an effective measurement, which starts off by taking a convex combination of 3 different measurements. And then after those measurements are complete, it does some classical post-processing on the outcome of those measurements. So I'll write down what the probabilities for each of these dice is. Each of these dice is actually a coin with just 2 outcomes. Well, actually, not this one. This one has 3 possible outcomes, which are equally weighted. So this just says you roll a dice to decide whether to measure MA, MB, or MC on the system, which are just the measurements associated with observable A, B, and C. And then if you happen to have gone this route and you measure A, then I distinguish the positive eigenvalue outcomes by the lines that go up and the negative eigenvalue outcomes by the lines that go down. And if you get one of the positive eigenvalue outcomes, you roll a dice, well, it's actually a coin, you flip a coin with probability of heads being given by the absolute value of the eigenvalue divided by that number r, which was large enough to ensure that this is really probability. And you just sort which outcome you got, the heads or the tails. And you do the same thing here. This will be a slightly different coin because this second eigenvalue will be different. And so what you do is you just collect, you want to record at the end just whether you got this heads outcome in these sorts of events. For if you happen to have measured the observable B, then it's the negative eigenvalue cases where you have a coin flipped, and it's the same sort of deal. The probability of the coin depends on the eigenvalue. And the same with C. And you collect all the heads outcomes together, and you forget all the details in here, and all you output out of this effective measurement is whether you got this outcome or one of the other many possible outcomes. So that's very elaborate. What's the point of all of it? Well, I want to show you that this is the effect that's associated with this crazy measurement is precisely the left-hand side of that equation I showed you earlier. Ask yourself, what the probability of, say, getting this outcome here, the very top branch? Well, you have a probability of 1/3 of actually going and getting measured along A. And then the probability of actually getting this eigenvalue, A plus, is given a preparation procedure P, is just something. And then, of course, you have to ask, well, what's the probability that I actually flipped the coin and got heads? And that's just A plus over R. In quantum theory, this probability here associated with the measurement is just trace of the projector onto the A plus eigenstate times rho. And so I can move these factors inside and find out what the effect is, and it's just this. And then I can ask, well, what is the indicator function I would associate with that top outcome in a Hin-Varian model? Well, the same kind of logic applies. With probability of 1/3, I actually measure A. And then the probability chi A plus lambda, I actually get the outcome A plus when the state of the system is lambda. And then with probability A plus over R, I get this head outcome. So this is the overall probability of that branch. And now if I just want to know what's the total probability of all the upward going branches, I just have to sum up over all the positive A eigenvalues, all the negative B eigenvalues, and all the negative C eigenvalues. And here's the effect. Here's the total effect associated in quantum theory with that outcome. And here's the indicator function that you have to use in the hidden variable model. OK, so note that that's the left-hand side of the equation I had a few slides back. All right, almost done. Now I just defined an equally complicated measurement, a second measurement. The only difference is now that the dies get rolled and I get negative eigenvalues for A and positive eigenvalues for B or C. And when I do all the same reasoning, I find that the effect associated with this measurement is the right-hand side of that equation I wrote down before. And here's what the indicator function looks like. OK, so now I'm ready to apply the assumption of non-contextuality. Because by assumption, these two ways of decomposing one effect tell me that these two measurement procedures I just defined are operationally equivalent. If I put this whole thing in a box and I do any preparation procedure you like, the statistics of this and this will be exactly the same. There's no way to distinguish them. The assumption of non-contextuality tells you when that occurs, describe them by exactly the same indicator function. And now we know what the indicator function for this and for this are. We just derived them. So I just set the indicator function associated with this guy equal to the indicator function associated with that guy. And that was my target, deriving this equation. What's important about that equation? Well, if I just multiply by 3r, and I take all my A negative eigenvalues back to this side, and the B and C negative eigenvalues back to that side, I get this equation. And that's just a fancy way of saying von Neumann's assumption. Because this is basically saying this is an indicator function. For given lambda, it tells me which eigenvalue is going to occur. So it has value 1 for one value of A. And so if I sum over the values of A times this function, I just pull out whatever eigenvalue lambda is going to specify. So that's this function here. And so I've got von Neumann's assumption from this convoluted path of reasoning. So that's nice. But I think there's a question that remains to be asked here, which is, do we really need to go and do that measurement that I just described, that convoluted measurement involving convex combinations and classical post-processing? Do we need to do that in the lab and verify, yes, these two measurements are equivalent operationally, you can't tell them apart, and therefore it's safe to make von Neumann's assumption? Or would it be sufficient to just go and do what von Neumann imagined, which is calculate statistics for A, find the mean value of A for all possible preparation procedures, and verify that the mean value of B plus the mean value of C is exactly the same as the mean value of A for every preparation procedure? Can't I just do that measurement? And the answer is, yes, you can. And I want to try to justify that to you. So here's the two measurements I imagined doing. And I want to ask the question, what's really the empirical content of saying that these things are operationally equivalent? Well, what it says is that the probability distribution I get, I get a list of probabilities. For every preparation procedure P, I get a probability assigned to every eigenvalue of A, every eigenvalue of B, and of C. So this is a bunch of data that I could just get by measuring A and B and C lots of times on these different preparation procedures. And the content of this assumption is that a particular convex combination of all these probabilities satisfies this equation. And one way to verify that these things really do satisfy that equation is by doing these kinds of convex combinations and classical post-processing. But why not just stick it in your computer? Accumulate this data in the lab, and then plug it into the computer with these coefficients and verify that this equation is satisfied. The reason that that's equivalent for our purposes is that the assumption of non-contextuality tells us that the way I represent this measurement device cannot depend on whether I preceded by the roll of a dice or not. It can't depend on whether I succeeded by the roll of a dice, because those things are irrelevant to how I represent it in the quantum formalism. And so that particular way of verifying this equation isn't important. I could instead just plug all the data into a computer and verify it that way. So if I can plug all this data with these coefficients, well, that's equivalent. Well, I guess I said all of this to you. Just numerically verify this equation after collecting that data. That's equivalent to just verifying this equation. I mean, I've just rewritten it by rearranging terms. And that's just the problem of verifying that the mean of the left-hand side is equal to the sum of the means of the terms on the right-hand side. So I argue that you may as well just do the measurement, which von Neumann recommended, to verify that this relation holds. Right. A few comments. Another way of proving this that's maybe less painful, but perhaps less obvious about what's going into the proof, is to just make use of this lemma, which says that if a function over positive operators satisfies this relation with positive coefficients, then it can be extended uniquely to a linear function over the Hermitian operators. And so this was actually sort of what I ended up proving in that particular example. It's proven in Paul Bush's PRL on generalizing Gleason's theorem to two-dimensional Hilbert spaces, and also in this paper here. And so mathematically, the key steps of the proof are what I showed you is the same. But I think by doing it the longer way, you see a bit more conceptually what you're actually assuming. So I'd be interested in Paul telling me what he feels the connection between what I've done and this sort of approach is. But the bottom line is that this general notion of non-contextuality can be used to derive von Neumann's assumptions. And that leads us to reassess this question of whether his assumptions really were silly. So Bell famously said that von Neumann's assumptions were silly. And then Merman picked up on this in his Red Mott Fizz article and also accused von Neumann of being silly. And actually, he says in a footnote that somebody in the audience once took him to task for calling von Neumann silly. And then he fell back on Bell and said that Bell had done it, so it's permissible. But let's go and see the argument that he gives for why it's a silly assumption. So he says, to require that the value of A plus B should be the sum of the value of A and the sum of the value of B in each individual system of the ensemble is to ensure that a relation holds in the mean by imposing it case by case, a sufficient but hardly a necessary condition. Silly. So basically saying, if you impose a condition that's sufficient but not necessary, then you're making a silly assumption. But now let's see what he says about the assumption in the Bell coefficient spectra theorem, which he takes to not be silly. So he basically says, if you do the experiment to measure A together with some commuting observables, B and C, so B and C commute with A in this case, on an ensemble of systems prepared in some state, and you ignore the results of these other observables, you get exactly the same statistics for A as you would have obtained had you instead done a quite different experiment to measure A together with L, M, etc. The obvious way to account for this, he says, particularly when entertaining the possibility of n variable theory, is to propose that both experiments reveal a set of values for A in the individual systems that is the same, regardless of which experiment we choose to extract them from. But the obvious way of accounting for something is just a sufficient but not a necessary condition for explaining that thing. So there's really no difference in the status of these two assumptions. Both the Bell coefficient spectra theorem and von Neumann's theorem make assumptions that are not necessary. They're merely sufficient for reproducing statistics. If the only justification you give for silliness is sufficiency but not necessity, then either both proofs are silly or neither proof is silly. And what I've argued here is I think neither proof is silly. I think they both teach us something interesting because von Neumann's assumptions can ultimately be derived by a more general notion of non-contextuality. Okay. Just a few last comments. If you go in literature, you'll find a number of NOGO theorems which actually make the same assumptions as von Neumann. For example, in Schrödinger's 1935 cat paper, he gives a little NOGO theorem wherein he imagines a system whose angular momentum is judged relative to two reference points. And he basically assumes that the operators are associated with variables. And all you really need to assume is that they satisfy von Neumann's assumptions. And what he then shows is that the spectrum relative to O is one set of values. But because the distance between O and O prime can be varied continuously, the spectrum relative to O prime can be made to be any other set of values with the same differences. So if you have angular momentum quantization with a particular spectrum relative to one point, you can't have it relative to another point. And it turns out that that's, again, just another way of proving von Neumann's NoGo theorem, and therefore another way of proving contextuality. Although there are subtleties here regarding the fact that these are unbounded operators. And so it's a bit, I think there's some work to be done here in making it rigorous, because we're going to have to turn these into effects and divide by the largest eigenvalue. And here, the largest eigenvalue is going to be infinite. So there are some subtleties. Another nice example, and again, I don't quite remember where this comes from. John Seif pointed this example out to me as an instance of von Neumann's NoGo theorem, which is just the fact that particles can be found in classically forbidden regions. So if you have, this is your Hamiltonian, and you make von Neumann's assumptions, so you associate each of these operators variables, and you prepare the state in an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian corresponding to some energy that's less than the potential somewhere, then by virtue of the fact that it's always possible to find the particle in the forbidden region, you can have values of lambda such that h minus v is negative. So here e minus v is negative. And so p squared would have to have a negative value. And that contradicts the assumption that the spectrum of p squared is positive. And so the existence of particles in classically forbidden regions becomes another instance of contextuality. So this sort of gives the flavor of how lots of different phenomena that we usually take to be sort of independent, separate, you know, ways of seeing how you can't understand quantum theory as a classical theory end up falling under this one umbrella. So let me just wrap up. The notion of non-contextuality should be separated from that of outcome determinism, I've argued. It can and should be. And it can be extended to both preparation procedures and unsharp measurement procedures. And it can be made operational. And therefore, just like locality, one can test whether the world is local as opposed to quantum theory being local. I argue that one can test whether the world is contextual independently of whether quantum theory is contextual. John Barrett has pointed out the fact that one cannot make this claim as strongly as one can for the case of locality. I think some of his objections are warranted. So there's work to be done here in making the notion of contextuality one that really is experimentally testable. And then finally, the overarching argument here has been that most notions of non-classicality we have seem to be understood as either resulting from some kind of epistemic restriction or as an instance of the generalized notion of contextuality. If there are instances of non-classicality that can be categorized in this way, then I think those are really interesting, and we should look into that and see if we can find such things. And I'll stop there. Thanks.
Time for discussion for questions.
One minor technical point.
Yes.
If you assume that there's values of the operators, let's say A lambda, that they are in the spectrum.
Yes, I did.
But then, for instance, your last example where you had the harmonic oscillator.
Yes.
You have the discrete eights and the two continuous.
Yes.
So how could that? I mean, on the right-hand side, there are much more values than on the left hand side. I mean, there are a lot of examples of where the sum of two non-commuting operators is, for instance, discrete, and those that you sum are not.
Right.
So
but is that enough to derive a contradiction, just an observation? Because all we say is the values have to be chosen from the spectrum. So if I have two continuous spectrum, then it's always possible to choose two values such
and
that it reduces it.
Apply only some values, for instance, for the kinetic energy and the potential energy.
Yes.
So you cannot go through all possible values of these.
Right. But that, yeah, you couldn't possibly vary, you know, have a lambda which had arbitrary values of p squared and the b of x term.
But this kinetic energy could have any non-negative value.
This enforces this argument, right?
I think if you, I'm not clear that this observation alone can derive, a, you can derive a contradiction from it, but if you can, then I'm happy. Yeah.
I think it's the same example. You can just bring one operator to the other side.
Yeah.
Then you reduce the contradiction.
Yes.
But I think it's the same contradiction as in this example of Captain Founder.
Okay. I have not saying that the quantum mechanics is non-local, meaning non-realistic or non-local Coriolis. Quantum theory is local.
Well, so in this, in this talk, whenever I've used the term locality, I've meant it in Bell's sense and not in the sense of signaling. So quantum theory is, if it's, the sense in which it's local is that it doesn't admit superluminal signaling. But that's not what I meant here. I meant that quantum theory is non-local in the sense that any hidden variable model of quantum theory fails to satisfy Bell's assumption of local causality.
What I want to ask is that non-contextuality is, has a different flavor to say non-realistic theory. I mean, when you're saying this outcome determinism,
yes,
I mean that it has more than just non-local correlations.
So when I say it's contextual, that subsumes the notion that it's non-local, but it's more general. So there are instances of correlations across time rather than correlations across space. There's certain correlations that you could say, those sorts of correlations can only occur in a contextual theory, whereas the issue of locality is whether correlations in space-like separated regions can occur or not. So I mentioned briefly that there's this thing called oblivious transfer, which is basically a way of transmitting forward in time two bits of information in such a way that later you can extract one or the other bit with a high probability of success, but no information about the parity. And it turns out that quantum theory and any contextual theory allows you to get those two bits with higher probability than you could in any classical theory. So that's sort of a quick snapshot of the kinds of correlations that contextuality accounts for.
So, frankly, back to today's when you're taking the SATs, I'd like to propose one of those analogy questions. The non-local is to no signaling.
Yes.
As contextual is to, there are these no signaling theories that are more non-local than quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
The no signaling provides
right.
a real hard back.
Yeah.
Is there something that is more contextual than quantum mechanics? And
yes. Yes, and it's what Matt and John have dubbed the contextual box, like the PR box. So, as of recently, I now realize that the contextual box is just a 1 out of 2 oblivious transfer protocol that works perfectly. So let me remind you what the definition of 1 out of 2 oblivious transfer is. So it's a cryptographic primitive where the sender inputs two bits, called x0 and x1. The receiver inputs one bit, y, and gets out one bit, b. And if the protocol is correct, B is X sub Y. So the receiver's bit specifies whether the receiver wants to get the first or the second bit out. And now, it's not part of the usual definition, but for my claims to work, you have to enhance the standard definition by specifying what's going to happen if the recipient wants to receive the parity of the two bits that the sender puts in. Because the regular security definition, which was made in the context of classical information theory, doesn't really specify what occurs in that case. All the security definition is typically said as follows. If the receiver gets any information about the first bit, then the receiver can get no information about the second bit, and vice versa. But what if the receiver says, well, I don't care to get any information about either the first or the second, but I want to get information about the parity? What then? It says nothing. So what I assume is that oblivious transfer ought to be defined such that the receiver gets no information about the parity. And what's nice about that definition is that it actually entails the other two. Because if you just tell me the receiver receives nothing about the parity, then were the receiver to obtain any information about X0, then he couldn't obtain information about X1 if he has no information about the parity, and vice versa. So it's a nice, simple security definition that gets the rest. What was it? So that's the protocol. And what you can show is that classically, if I want to the receiver to get nothing about the parity, then I have to send either the first bit or the second bit. I can't send their AND or their OR or any other non-trivial Boolean function with two bits. It has to be just one or the other. That's pretty straightforward to show. And if you're just sending one of the two bits, then the maximum probability that the receiver gets the bit he wants is 3/4. If he happens to want the one you sent, he gets it with probability 1. That occurs half the time. If he wants the other bit, he's out of luck. He has to guess. He has probability half guessing right. That occurs half the time. Total probability 3/4. Now, what you can prove is that in quantum theory, you can make that probability 85% and maintain the receiver gets no information about the parity still. And I'm going to show you that protocol. It's basically the same protocol that you use for random access code. So this is a disk on the block sphere. These are four pure states. These are the pure states Alice encodes for these four possibilities for her two-bit values. And then if Bob wants the first bit, he measures along this basis. And so he has high probability of guessing whether the first bit is 0 or 1. If he wants the second bit, he measures along this basis. And it turns out that you can show that his probability getting what he wants correctly is 0.85. But he gets no information about the parity because the zero parity state, if I take the mixture of this and this, it's exactly the same as the mixture of this and this. So there's no measurement you can do that'll tell him which of those two ensembles was prepared. So one way of expressing this assumption that there's no information about the parity that can get through to the receiver is that the message system that the sender puts in, if I sum up the probability of a given message for 0, 0 and for 1, 1, I get the same thing as if I sum it up for 0, 1 and 1, 0. So zero parity and one parity possibilities. So this is a way of encoding the assumption that no information about the parity gets forward. And in the context of a hidden variable theory, this is what you get by virtue of the parity obliviousness constraint. So in an arbitrary theory, you're going to demand that the sender do one of four preparation procedures, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And the receiver should receive no information about whether it was one of these two or one of those two. And so you can say that the probability of the receiver getting a particular outcome of his measurement, given that it was P naught naught, plus the probability of getting that outcome, given that it was P 1-1, should be the same as if it was not 1 plus 1 naught. And then you've got sort of operational equivalence between one mixture of preparation procedures and another mixture of preparation procedures. Then you use non-contextuality to basically deduce that, therefore, the distribution over lambdas, given 0, 0 plus 1, 1, has to be the same as the sum of the distribution given 0, 1, and 1, 0. And that's just exactly what you assume for the classical protocol. So you find that your non-contextual hidden variable models can only do as well as the classical protocol. Anyhow, so that's the long answer to your question. It's oblivious transfer. That's what contextuality is.
other question?
So you suggest that this might be a list of or it needs to be added to classical reality to quantum mechanics. So any idea how this may lead to quantum computational speed-up and basic gravity? Because clearly it's not the first.
I'm not sure that it will lead to computational speed-up. It's an interesting question. So I'm not claiming that necessarily, you know, every non-classical phenomena is contextuality. But it's certainly an interesting conjecture. And so, you know, you can try to disprove it. It's a target. In the past, I've sort of put up quotes by Feynman, the first paper on why quantum computers might yield an advantage, effectively says, if I want to model this experiment, I need negative quasi-probability representations. And so by what I said, negative quasi-probability representations are just instances of contextuality. So with this gloss, Feynman was basically saying, I suspect that quantum computers will be able to do better because quantum theory is contextual. That doesn't mean that contextuality does power exponential speed. I guess really I'm looking for some other principle that sort of makes contextuality seem natural. So I don't just want to assume contextuality. I kind of want to see what it is, what physical principle from which I could derive contextuality. John?
Just wondering, how many examples do you have of non-classical theories which are really non-contextual? We have your toy theory for one. I was actually wondering if there would be anything that would fit into the framework I and Matt were talking about, which your toy theory doesn't fit into because it has constraints on measurements. I tend to assume that all the objects are And I suppose part of the reason I'm asking is because it's a slight concern that maybe sort of all of those theories turn out to be contextual. Most of them somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course it sort of becomes trivial that non-classicality and contextuality somehow coincide. I mean, you wouldn't really say then that one is due to the other, it's just that it's there at the same time. So let me formulate a precise question then. Do you think there are any completely non-classical ones in the framework I described?
Do I think they're completely non-classical?
Completely non-contextual non-classical.
Completely non-contextual non-classical models within the Arden framework.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it is true that all the non-contextual models that I know of, which are classical, don't have a full, they have convex combination, only limited notion of convex combination, and so they don't fit into your framework. But it's an interesting question.
It's the kind of question that used to be solved in the good old days overnight by one of the opponents. So we look forward to tomorrow.
Yeah. To respond to the first half of your question, if you're seeking an axiomatization of quantum theory that is operational in nature, then there are many phenomena that might seem generic. You could say, almost all operational theories have these phenomena, and maybe contextuality is such a phenomena. But the kind of game I'm playing is slightly different, which is I really want to stick with a realist interpretation. So I want to start with something that looks classical, introduce an epistemic constraint, and then do something else, which I wouldn't characterize as abandoning realism, but rather modifying one of my realist presumptions, like moving to a radically relational theory. That's my slogan. I don't know what it means, but there's something that corresponds to moving to a radically relational theory, wherein you don't need to become operational, you're still a realist, but you know, you've bought yourself some more power for drawing upon the theory. And so within that sort of approach, it may be that something that's operationally generic is difficult to achieve. And so that's why I think contextuality might be significant from that perspective. Does that move you at all, or?
Sorry, I understood what you said. You know, a nice thing about, say, an epistemic description is that it gives you a nice reason for why you might have a state space which isn't a symmetric.
Right.
As opposed to just saying it's not. And then if all these features follow, because your state space is not a symmetric, like you actually explain that.
Yes, it's contextual. Every hidden variable model of quantum mechanics that fits into the framework I described has to be contextual. So even the traditional Noether theorems show that to us. And all this generalization really does is say, you give me some experimental data, which by the lights of the old notion of non-contextuality wasn't a proof of contextuality. You know, you said you have 17 different preparation procedures and 5 different measurement procedures, and here's the data you've got. A larger set of those experimental data will now be judged proofs of contextuality. The main result, which is that there are no non-contextual hidden variable model, hasn't changed. Robin?
So I just came up with this, so this may not even be a logically consistent question.
I have to give a logically consistent answer.
totally up to you. So this morning we saw examples of these operational theories that don't have epistemic restraints, where you seem to be leaning towards the idea that a lot of them are contextual. Maybe all, it's a classical theory. And you've got a model that's not operational and has an epistemic constraint and is non-contextual. Can you take a model that is contextual and start slamming epistemic constraints on it, limiting what you can measure, and eventually end up with something that is non-contextual?
And just measure the identity.
Yeah.
Yes, fine. But that's sort of trivial. I mean, do you get somewhere interesting with that?
Constrained quantum theory is the classical theory.
Yeah.
But I guess in general, I come up with some goofy model that is contextual. Is there a natural way to put on some epistemic constraints and get out of a non-contextual model?
Identify the minimal set of measurements you need to make a proof of contextuality and say you can't have access to it.
Yeah, I think that. What you're left with is a classical model, possibly a probabilistic model. But yeah, I don't think you'd get much interesting out of that. But it's unclear all the ways in which you could restrict measurements.
It's probably my first question.
I'll think about it.
While waiting for other questions, I want to pose a trivial question. When you say epistemic constraint, I am a little bit embarrassed because epistemic means knowledge about what? So, because constraint. Can I constrain the knowledge of what? Reality?
Or? Yes. So the research program basically says there's a pre-existing reality. Quantum states are states of knowledge about that reality.
Right. But then you need to define reality.
Yes.
And what is the definition of reality?
Well, if you mean you need to specify the state space, you know, the space of all possibilities, then the answer to your question is that it hasn't been done.
So you start from a state space and then restrict the knowledgeability of these states. This is abstract. So you define this constraint in an abstract complex theory way.
Yeah, so maybe I'm not understanding your question properly, but all I've done is not derive quantum theory. All I've done is I said, suppose you have some state space and you put an epistemic restriction on it. Well, you get a theory that's not quantum theory. But hey, it looks a lot like quantum theory. It's got a lot of the phenomena that quantum theory has. And you know, you can do it in a different way, a different state space, different kind of restriction. And you know, for discrete variables, for continuous variables, you can play this trick in a few different ways, and you get the same sort of lesson emerging, that these sorts of restrictions seem to be good at generating a lot of quantum theory. So maybe there's an axiomatization of quantum theory that has an epistemic restriction to one of the axioms, but I can't tell you what the state space for that axiomatization of quantum theory should be. You know, that's unsolved. So if I'm understanding your question right, I guess I just have to say that I'm trying to argue that quantum states are states of knowledge without telling you what they're knowledge about. So you know, I'd say they look like they're states of knowledge about something, but I don't know specifically what the structure of that something is.
Well, although you know some things about it, you know, for example, there has to be, for even just to describe a qubit, there has to be essentially a continuum of hidden variables.
That's right.
For example, can we say that your new notion of contextuality is can be just a consequence of defining reality not instead of outcomes but instead of probabilities? The probability is real, not the outcomes.
Well, in this sort of approach, it seems to be one of the ingredients of this approach is that you're not taking an attitude towards probabilities that makes them objective. It's sort of a Bayesian approach to probability. I have not carefully, you know, wondered whether all of this makes sense if you take the notion of an approach to probability wherein it's propensity. So
there was a transparency in which you were saying something very similar to that when you define your notion of contextuality.
Yes. So that I do assume that, you know, if I feed in a system and it's in state lambda, nonetheless the outcome might not be fixed. But that doesn't imply that there's objective stochasticity in the theory, because it might be that if I further condition on hidden variables inside the apparatus, the outcome does become determined. So what I call outcome determinism for sharp measurements, I chose that name because it's a question of whether the outcomes of the measurement are deterministic, not whether the underlying dynamics of the theory is deterministic. So it's really just, if I only condition on the properties of the system that's being fed into the device, does the outcome get predicted with probability 1 or not? But that leaves open the question of whether there's some further things that I condition on that would make that
any toy theories where you look at these epistemic restrictions, you're only considering finite dimensions? Is that true?
Well, the one I flashed for one overhead was a toy theory that was analogous to collections of qubits. Right. So it didn't even work well for three-level systems. There's sort of an analog of it that works well for three-level systems and collections of three-level systems. There's a different toy theory that works for continuous variable systems. So if you have spatiotemporal degree of freedom, say some number of particles in space, say three-dimensional space, you can write down an epistemic restriction, which is essentially Heisenberg's uncertainty principle but where the uncertainties of position and momentum just relate to the uncertainties that are defined by a possible probability distribution. So effectively, it's like saying the only classical probability distributions that are allowed are ones where delta x delta p is very equal to some minimal value. And then you also demand that it maximize the entropy subject to that constraint. And what you get is a theory that, again, reproduces a lot of quantum mechanics. It actually reproduces all a subset of quantum mechanics, which is the Gaussian states, Gaussian transformations, and Gaussian measurements. And so that's an infinite dimensional Hilbert space.
Does it buy you anything more than what the finite dimensional
is? Not clear. They seem analogous to one another. One thing that's easier in the continuous vertical case is to make sense of sort of like a von Neumann chain. What you'd like to do is be able to treat your measurement apparatus within the theory. So you can treat it as external if you like, or you can incorporate it as a dynamical degree of freedom in the theory. That's a lot easier to do in this continuous variable model than it is in these plane models, because it's very hard to build apparatuses out of a bunch of qubits. So it has some advantages, but I'm not sure that it's ultimately they're significant as opposed to the fact, you know, just that we haven't really seen how, you know, what the analog a feature in one model is in the other model.
There are no other questions. We can start our coffee break. Right.